Are the kids all right to vote? This November, statewide and in the Bay Area, voters will be deciding whether the voting age should be lowered to 16 or 17 in certain types of elections. Is your teenager ready to vote? Critics say they lack the critical thinking skills necessary. Advocates say that young people are deeply affected by issues facing voters and their voice deserves to be heard. We'll break down the issue later this hour, and we'll also be talking to Pete Cronowit, a local musician who's using music to get out the vote. But first, we're talking about Senator Dianne Feinstein. Last week, at the conclusion of the Amy Coney Barrett confirmation hearings, Feinstein ended her remarks by hugging a maskless Lindsey Graham and thanked him for his work.
Mr. Chairman, I just want to thank you. This has been one of the best set of hearings that I've participated in, and I want to thank you for your fairness and the opportunity of going back and forth. It leaves one with a lot of hopes, a lot of questions, and even some ideas, perhaps some good bipartisan legislation we can put together to make this great country even better. So thank you so much for your leadership.
Democrats were not happy with this performance. And to give us more context on this story, I'm pleased to be joined by Tal Copen, Washington correspondent for the San Francisco Chronicle. Thanks for joining me, Tal.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
So when these hearings started, Feinstein called the proceedings unprecedented and predicted they would create a lot of bad will. She ends it by hugging Lindsey Graham. What happened, Tal?
Some might say that her openings were scripted and her closings were not. You know, going into these hearings, even before we knew there was going to be a Supreme Court fight, progressives were really anxious about having Dianne Feinstein continue to be the top Democrat on the Judiciary Committee for this exact reason. They really believe that Republicans have fundamentally changed the game on judges, and Democrats need someone in that seat who's going to fight and bring fire, as they put it, and, you know, basically fight fire with fire, in the sense that they believe Republicans are using dirty tactics and they need a Democrat who's going to, you know, not be afraid to get in the trenches. And that is just not Dianne Feinstein. I mean, she still harkens back to a day where the Senate functioned as a bipartisan institution, where there was respect for each other in a way that we just don't see these days. And so, you know, I think what we saw at the end of that hearing was Dianne Feinstein, who really still believes that there's good faith and a chance for bipartisan working together.
Well, and she got some fire back at her. NARAL, the pro-choice group, pulled their support for her on Friday, and their president said that the ranking member of the Senate Judiciary Committee failed to make this clear, that Amy Coney Barrett and this was a power grab, basically, and in fact offered an appearance of credibility to the proceedings that is wildly out of step with the American people. And then NARAL called for her to step down. Are more Democrats or Democratic organizations calling for the same thing?
NARAL is probably the biggest name, but there are a lot of groups on the left. I mean, Demand Justice, which is a group started by a former aide to Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer of New York. He also worked for Hillary Clinton's 2016 campaign, Brian Fallon. He's one of the leaders of the group. They were calling for Feinstein to step down back in June, July, just looking ahead. I talked to them for a story in the Chronicle. They were concerned that Clarence Thomas might retire at the end of the term to try to give Trump a chance to appoint someone younger to his seat. And they didn't want Feinstein to go through that. You could argue that the death of Ruth Bader Ginsburg was their worst case scenario outcome, because not only did it bring up a Supreme Court fight, but it was one that now changes the balance of the court. And so there was already groups out there, Ultraviolet was another, that was saying Feinstein probably shouldn't be in charge of this committee. That has now grown. And you could probably argue that this is one of the biggest moments of doubt that Feinstein has faced in her career in many, many years. You know, she had a challenger in the last election cycle, but she won. But she never faced this kind of vocal opposition from really prominent groups on the left.
Has she said anything since the infamous hug? Has she responded to NARAL's pulling their support of her?
I believe she put out a statement saying, you know, one, that she believes that Amy Coney Barrett is unfit to serve, that this was a sham hearing. She will be voting no. You know, she has faced criticism already leading into these hearings. There's a somewhat infamous story that ran in Politico quoting some of her colleagues questioning her mental fitness for these hearings and whether she would be up for it. In that, she defended herself. She said she thinks she does a good job. She makes the points that she needs to make. So she and, you know, many of her colleagues who will speak on the record still defend her and say, what else could she have really done? Democrats are going to, or I'm sorry, Republicans are going to steamroll what they want to steamroll. It's not like if she had shown up and yelled at everyone that Amy Coney Barrett wouldn't be confirmed. I mean, that's just not how the Senate works.
There didn't seem to be much fireworks or kind of sound bites out of Feinstein's questioning of Amy Coney Barrett. But when Coney Barrett was up for her appellate judgeship, there was a back and forth with her and Feinstein that I think sort of had a shadow over how Feinstein performed here. That was the comments about Coney Barrett's Catholicism. Do you think that those comments kind of hampered Feinstein this time around?
I don't know about hampered, but I think it redirected the strategy. So the fact that this more or less the same committee had a confirmation hearing for this same judge, it kind of had pros and cons for all of them. So it gave Democrats a chance to anticipate how she was going to be performing and sort of adjust their strategy. Republicans could do the same. It meant that Barrett had already been vetted to an extent. She had some practice with these hearings. So it sort of gave everyone a chance to come in with a little bit of experience under their belt. And the comments you're referencing were Feinstein sort of making the point that she said the words that have been quoted is the dogma lives loudly within you. And she was arguing that Barrett would not be able to fairly decide, you know, cases like issues of abortion because of her devout Catholic faith. And that really backfired. Republicans seized on those comments as evidence of sort of anti-religion bias, anti-Catholic bias. And we kept hearing that during these hearings. The Republicans were shadow boxing with Dianne Feinstein in 2017. She said nothing of the sort this time around. That's all preamble to say, I don't know if it restrained her. I think Democrats learned from that, learned from Kavanaugh, and learned from the way that Barrett was likely going to be approaching these hearings, that they didn't want to make this hearing about themselves. And I actually talked to someone from People for American Way who said she thought that Democrats did a great job, that the focus on healthcare was the right focus, and that if Democrats became the story, that they hadn't done the right job, because ultimately the focus right now should be on convincing on the electorate that is headed to the polls as we speak and going into November. They're the ones who should be thinking about this hearing and not theatrics.
Right. And I think maybe the hug with Lindsey Graham might have been a hug too far for many Democrats. And Katie Porter down in the congresswoman from Southern California said that she found that the hearings were not one of the best and not even acceptable. You mentioned that Feinstein had a challenger in the primary. You know, we know she's 87 years old. She's represented the California state since 1992, so for almost 33 years. Mm-hmm. It seems not likely, or maybe it is likely, that she's going to run again in 2024. But it seems unlikely that she'll go without a primary challenger. Who do you think is interested in that job, and what do you think will happen there?
Oh my goodness, there are so many steps along the way. I don't think we can even begin to unpack that. You know, there are some out there who think she will retire before she runs again. I mean, who knows? I'm not saying that on any sourcing that's, you know, breaking news. It's sort of one of those ever-present pieces of conventional wisdom or conjecture. But 4 years is a long time from now. And the other big if is what happens with the other Senate seat in California. You know, if Senator Kamala Harris becomes Vice President Harris, or even, you know, there are other possibilities that happen, but if she becomes Vice President Harris, then you have the open seat. Newsom can appoint someone to it until the end of her term, which I believe is in 2 years, and then there'll be another election. So, you know, even if we're talking about Feinstein running again and who challenges her, you're talking about several elections from now when there may have been people who have gotten to run. But I think we all know that in California, there's a lot of political talent and very few statewide offices, and those races can get extremely heated.
So there's fireworks and horse jockeying to look forward to. I wanted to just touch base again on that point you brought up about bipartisanship. You know, Feinstein kind of heralds back to an age when people across the aisle got along with each other. And in this election cycle, we're hearing a lot from politicians, maybe not at the top of the ticket, but saying that, you know, hey, I'm going to work across the aisle. That's what I'm good for. Vote for me. I know how to work both sides. Is that a viable argument in this heated political environment right now? I mean, is bipartisanship over?
I mean, gosh, viable for whom?
Yeah. Well, in California, you know, I guess. In California.
There's always the chance, right? And the truth is, as much as I think fairly we malign Congress as being completely fundamentally broken, I think that's a fair assessment. There are still plenty of things that get done that aren't really drawing a lot of attention on a bipartisan basis. I mean, this Senate has passed some really significant public lands bills, you know, which they don't make a lot of headlines, but they're pretty big deals. And those get done because a few bipartisan minded lawmakers kind of work behind the scenes. They don't get a lot. They don't draw a lot of fire or attention. And when they've got something ready to go, they can actually ship it out. So it's not that bipartisanship is totally dead. But I mean, when you look at something like the coronavirus relief negotiations that are happening right now, which Nancy Pelosi is negotiating on behalf of the House, which is controlled by Democrats, Steven Mnuchin is trying to represent the administration with ebb and flow influence from Chief of Staff Mark Meadows. Mitch McConnell, who leads the Senate, is just kind of sitting on the sidelines with popcorn, being like, good luck getting whatever you guys agree to through my Senate, because over there, Republicans only want about a fraction of what Pelosi and Mnuchin are discussing. You know, if there's anything that can show you how broken Washington is and how difficult it is for the two parties to agree, it's something like relief in the middle of a pandemic where hundreds of thousands of people are dying, millions are sick, and millions more are struggling. So not a particularly optimistic view on that one.
Yeah, I guess that's what that is bringing people to the polls and all those long lines that we're seeing. People want some change. So this Thursday, I believe there's going to be a vote on Barrett's nomination. Do you think that we'll hear anything from Feinstein about that? Will she backstep her praise of Lindsey Graham?
I would imagine that her statement at that hearing will be a little more pointed. You know, I bet she'll be reading from prepared remarks and there will be less ad-libbing. We'll have to see how much Democrats try. That's an opportunity where we might see fireworks because the Democrats who show up might try to show a little fight, I guess. And, you know, there isn't much they can do. If the majority in the Senate wants to do something, they can do it. And even the rules that supposedly exist, like if they were to boycott the hearing, they're supposed to have two members of the minority present to hold a vote. You know, Democrats could boycott, which Feinstein in the past has not been a fan of tactics like that. But even if they did, Republicans can just move to change the rules, and then they've changed the rules and they can confirm her that way anyway. So, you know, it's possible that we will see Democrats try to show fight, but again, it's mostly for the show. And at the end of the hearing, it's almost certain that Barrett will be voted to advance, and then we'll see her on the Senate floor, likely confirmed by Election Day.
Well, thank you for that excellent analysis of DeFi's status, Tal. And that was Tal Copen. She's the Washington correspondent and senior political reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle. Thank you again for being on.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Great. And coming up next on City Visions, are the kids all right to vote? We'll be talking about the movement to lower the voting age. Welcome back to City Visions. I'm Grace Wan. In 1971, the national voting age was lowered to 18 from 21, and now, nearly 50 years later, some youth advocates want to lower it further to 16 or 17. On this November's ballot, voters will be deciding whether to lower the voting age in certain state and local elections. And with me to talk about these measures and the youth vote are Ariana Nasiri, the former San Francisco Youth Commissioner and a Vote 16 SF campaign leader. Welcome, Ariana.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Right. We also have Tyler Okoke. He's the Vote at 16 youth organizer for Power California. He's also a former student board member of the LA Unified School District. Welcome, Tyler.
Thank you so much.
And finally, we have John Trusvina. He's the California Executive Director at Generation Citizen. Welcome, John.
Nice to be with you, Grace.
Great. And we'd love to hear from you. Should teenagers be given the right to vote? Give us a call at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Or you can send us an email at cityvisions@kalw.org or find us on Twitter. So, John, I wanted to start with you. There are a couple of ballot measures, depending on where you live, regarding the youth vote. Can you give us a brief rundown of what they are, what they do, and on which ballot they are?
Yes, thank you. Right here in San Francisco, we have Proposition G. Proposition G would allow 16 and 17-year-olds the right to vote in all of our local elections, supervisor, mayor, the school board, and the various propositions. Proposition Double Q across the Bay in Oakland would extend the vote, would share the franchise for the school board elections to 16 and 17-year-olds. And statewide, we have Proposition 18, which stands for having if you're turning 18 by November, you can vote in the primary. Now, 23 other states do that. San Francisco would be the largest state by far in the nation that would permit 16 and 17-year-olds the right to vote.
And can you give us a sense? So you said 23 states already have a rule similar to Proposition 18. Do a lot of other states and cities have rules that allow 16-year-olds to vote in school boards or municipal voting for 16 or 17-year-olds?
A number of cities and towns in Maryland have it, primarily in Maryland, and there it's worked very, very well because 16 and 17-year-olds vote at a higher rate than those who are 18 and older. In 2014, right after Tacoma Park put it into place, 72% of the people surveyed in a special election said, this is great. We're glad that we've extended the franchise to 16 and 17-year-olds, and it makes sense. When you expand democracy, you really strengthen the democracy.
Well, Ariana, I want to turn to you. You're a former San Francisco Youth Commissioner, and I understand you worked really hard to get Prop G on the ballot. But San Franciscans rejected a similar measure back in 2016 to lower the voting age. Why revive it now?
Sure. So I wasn't directly involved with the campaign in 2016. However, looking at the youth activism and youth mobilization that's kind of been catalyzed by the results of the 2016 election, you're looking at a completely different demographic and therefore completely different conversations regarding the efficacy of youth and their essentially their role in society and their role as civically engaged citizens. So if you look at movements like Black Lives Matter, the Green New Deal, March for Our Lives, these are all national initiatives where youth essentially sat as the trailblazers and as the representatives of these campaigns. And since 2016 and since these initiatives have taken place and legislative reform has been catalyzed by these movements, a lot of conversations are taking place this year that simply just were not being had in 2016. And we believe that the uptick in support we've seen for Vote 16 is directly catalyzed by this media, now the media representation of the work that young people have been doing for essentially decades in San Francisco.
Right. And Tyler, in Los Angeles, you were on the school board, and there's a similar measure regarding 16-year-olds voting in school board elections. Tell us about that.
Yes. So in April 2019, I worked with a grassroots organization called Power California, to introduce a resolution to study the feasibility of having 16 and 17-year-olds vote in school board elections. The solvency of that resolution was set for spring of this year, but we know that with the pandemic, the focus of the district has obviously and with good intention shifted. So we'll be looking out for updates for that in the meantime, though.
And in Berkeley, locally, we have they did pass a 16-year-olds voting in school board elections. I think that passed with 70% of voters in favor of that. John, how has that worked out so far?
Well, unfortunately, it has not worked out because of problems with the, unlike San Francisco, where the city and county run the elections and vote, the Berkeley school board elections are conducted by the by Alameda County. And there's been some difficulties in administering the vote, having separate voting rolls. So that has not yet happened.
All right. So something to be seen. So I wanted to ask Ariana and Tyler, and just for our viewers, our listeners to know, how old are you guys? Ariana?
I turned 18 a month ago.
And Tyler, how old are you?
I turned 19 in July.
You're so articulate. One would not know that you are necessarily 18 and 19-year-olds. But I want to ask, what's so great about 16 versus 18? You know, when the 26th Amendment was passed in 1971, you know, they lowered the voting age from 21 to 18 in response to people being drafted into the Vietnam War and this idea that if you're going to fight, then you should at least get to vote. But why is 16 so special? Is like 16 the new 18, Tyler?
Right. So what we know is that 18 is not working. We see that in the low voter turnout between people that are 18 to 23. And namely, it's so low because 18 to 23 is such a transitionary time in young people's lives. That's when we move off to college, when we leave the home and find new jobs. There's just so much happening. But what we've seen is that when we introduce voting at 16, when students are in stable environments and usually often taking a U.S. history course of some type, they're able to put the practical lens in the theory that they're learning behind, like the creation of the United States. And we've also seen that when young people vote in their first two consecutive elections, that they become lifelong habitual voters. And to make the case and kind of compare our generation to that of the 70s when the voting age was lowered to 18, we are also a generation, like Ariana mentioned, that has been deeply involved in the movements of our time and have been the vanguard of progressive change in our country. And as long as we continue to be affected deeply by the policies that are being made now, or namely climate inaction, inaction when it comes to racial equity, and inaction when it comes to strengthening our schools and our economy for young people, those are the things that we must have a say in because they affect the type of life that we'll lead in the future.
Yeah, and I think we're seeing with activists like Greta Thunberg and Malala, the kids from Parkland High School, that really young people are at the front of important movements like climate change, rights for girls, and gun control. But are you worried that giving 16-year-olds these rights might also give them other rights and responsibilities that they might not want, like being treated as an adult under the law, lowering the age of consent, being tried as an adult? What do you think about that, Ariana?
Sure. And that's a conversation we have a lot on the trail. And the reason why we tend to keep our Vote 16 or our election enfranchisement expansion movements to a local level is to essentially mitigate that possibility. So the idea of expanding, you know, the general rights, there are certain rights that are written into the Constitution that are federal regulations around the rights that one's granted when they turn 18. However, the reason why Vote 16 is local is that it's not a constitutional amendment, it's a local charter amendment, and it would only allow for voter participation and voter enfranchisement on a local level. And, you know, I believe that there is some concern that, oh, young people don't necessarily want all of these rights. However, young people are oftentimes being treated like adults in the political system, especially on a local level. So if they're expected to pay taxes on a local level, if they're expected to be enrolled in school systems and be impacted by these political systems, they deserve at least the right to have a say in how these systems are being run and who is being elected to represent them. So we believe that that's the main argument for why they deserve this right versus, you know, the right to serve on a jury and the right to be tried as an adult. However, young people are being treated and expected to participate in the level that adults are oftentimes, and therefore deserve that level of representation.
I think one of the biggest arguments you hear against this idea of 16-year-olds voting comes from the idea that, you know, 16-year-olds are just not mature enough. And I wanted to read a comment that I saw on Nextdoor that I was scrolling through. And maybe Nextdoor isn't like the ultimate political litmus test. But one person wrote in, I have a 16-year-old and I'm against this proposal. While we talk about civics in our home, kids at that age are too invested in their social currency and the herd mentality of what others think is cool and then putting it on social media. Then this is just a ploy to get captive teenage audience to tip the edge in order to pass things like school bond debt and attack Prop 13. Kids just aren't mature enough. So I think that kind of encapsulates a lot of the fears that voters have about giving rights to teenagers. You know, on one minute they're doing TikTok dances and the next minute they're going to be deciding a school bond proposal. That just doesn't seem like where we want them to be. So Tyler, I'll go to you. What do you say to that voter?
Number one, we can do both. We can make TikTok.
I think people my age can't do both, but maybe you can.
And it's also important that we don't conflate immaturity with a difference in political opinion, because that seems like the point that was made there was that this would be used to push progressive policies, which is true because our generation is more progressive than most younger generations. But it's also important that we really look in and understand the generation that we're dealing with, especially in 2020 when we are so deeply connected by technology to the struggles of the world. Not having access to social media is not a downside and is not a hindrance to us being civically engaged. It actually allows us to be even more deeply in touch with the needs of our communities and the needs of folks outside of it. So I say that, like, our attention to social currency, our attention to the digital age is actually what makes us more prepared to be civically engaged formally in our politics today.
Well, Arianna, what do you say to that argument that 16-year-olds, 17-year-olds are just not mature enough to handle the responsibility of voting on, you know, municipal elections are complicated. This particular ballot has split locally things to do with taxation, how to deal with homelessness, this measure. So it's not without complications.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'd like to preface this response by introducing that I initially was not a fan of Vote 16. I was introduced to the campaign when I was 13. And although I was working government at the time, I knew that majority of my peers did not have the kind of the civic preparedness that I did. So I was vehemently opposed to the idea of expanding enfranchisement. But over the course of my 4 years in high school, I went to a very humanities-focused high school, and I actually researched the language in the U.S. Constitution. That was my senior capstone project. So over the course of the 4 years, I was researching specifically the language around voter enfranchisement and what those regulations have been historically and what they will develop and eventually become and what they should become. And that is kind of essentially what disbanded and dissolved my opposition to Vote 16. And it's this idea that social maturity and political maturity are two separate entities, and they are not codependent on one another. So if we are to argue that young people should be disenfranchised on the grounds of social maturity, first of all, social maturity needs to be defined in a charter amendment, and therefore the entire currently eligible electorate needs to be reevaluated, and many currently enfranchised adults would no longer be deemed able to vote. So social maturity is very much an unconstitutional argument to determine who does or does not have the right to vote. However, civic maturity is an interesting way to look at it. And in San Francisco, the average 16 and 17-year-old is more civically mature than the currently eligible voter, because currently in San Francisco, we have a mandated civics education program in those first 2 years of high school. So going back to your question of why 16, by the age of 16, the average San Francisco young person has experienced at least a year of civics education. And should Vote 16 be implemented, San Francisco Unified School Districts would implement a curriculum prior to each election that would educate these young people on the propositions they would be voting on. So essentially, by allowing these 16 and 17-year-olds to vote, at least in San Francisco, you're increasing the median number of years of civic education that the entire electorate has, therefore making this electorate more kind of essentially aware of the decisions they're making rather than just voting along party lines.
Well, we're talking about the youth vote and whether we're all prepared for our teenagers to be voting. Give us a call at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-255. You can send us an email at cityvisions@kalw.org. I think let's take a call now. We've got Kolja from San Francisco. Kolja, welcome to City Visions.
Yeah, I'm just curious about the Constitution aspect here, because you've got two constitutions, one for the state of California and, of course, the federal one, and trying to pass this with the state, I'm just wondering if there might be some ramifications from the federal, interpretation with the Constitution, the main one, would have issues with this. So I'd be kind of interested to hear commenting on that.
Well, John, let's bring you into this conversation. What about the constitutionality of this?
Well, it's clearly constitutional. The federal Constitution says having a voting age above 18 is unconstitutional. It doesn't say anything about below 18. As for the state does have the 18-year-old requirement. However, San Francisco is a charter city, like 41 other charter cities around the state. And as a charter city, we are able to make our own decisions about suffrage. It's been reviewed, and this is clearly constitutional. And I think Ariana's comments about we don't have any of these special tests for adult voters. So this is not for everybody. Just like voting is not for everyone. We allow people to vote, but doesn't require them to vote. The arguments about young people not being ready or they're going to be swayed by their parents. Well, those are the same 19th century arguments made against the women's right to vote. And people assumed that women were just busy with other things. They would just vote the way their husbands would vote. And now we see in 2020, we have the greatest gender divide in voting. And at national level, women clearly do not vote the same way as men.
Well, I want to push back a little bit on that. I mean, I'm not sure that it's so identical to women getting the right to vote versus what we're talking about here, in that there, I think that voters who are worried about the propositions or opposed to it are thinking about the life experience that somebody has at 16 that they could bring to the ballot box on these particular issues, and whether the person is civically mature or has the prefrontal cortex ability to parse through that, they might not have the life experience that they could bring to making those decisions. And Tyler, what do you say to that? That at 16, you have mostly lived at home. If you're fortunate to have parents or guardians, you mostly have had things taken care of for you. So what kind of experience are you bringing to the table?
I think the idea of being taken care of is not something that sits well with a lot of working young people, particularly young people of color up and down our state who have been doing above and beyond what they're required in their homes, who've been helping their parents navigate the system of the United States immigration system, public service system, who take care of their siblings, who work jobs and contribute to their home. I also would say broadly for our generation that we bring the experience of coming of age in the age of school shootings, right? We bring the experience of coming in of age in the era when we are worried about climate inaction. We come of age in the era of Ferguson and of Trayvon Martin and now of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor. So these are all experiences that really shape how we understand the world and how we understand politics. And these are the types of issues that we'll bring light to and that we'll give vigor to if we were allowed the right to vote.
Well, we have a call out here. We have Zara Ahmed. She's a host on TBH, which is a KALW podcast. Are you there, Zara? Oh, okay. I guess she's not there. Let's take a different call. We've got Starchild.
Yes. Hi. Thanks for taking the call. I believe that there should not be any age cutoff for voting. If there is any test to say that some people aren't eligible to vote, it should be an individual test based on stuff like civics knowledge and general judgment and responsibility. One-size-all never works, and this is part of the problem with government is they have all these one-size-fits-all rules. Going back to the first American War of Secession, more commonly known as the American Revolution, no taxation without representation was one of the big slogans. And, of course, 16, 17-year-olds and younger people, like everybody else, have to pay taxes in one form or another. You know, they have their money taken from them by government under threat of violence if they don't pay. That's what taxation is. And if you're going to subject people to that kind of thing, absolutely, yeah, they should have a say in who makes those decisions about how much of their money is going to get stolen and this kind of thing.
Well, thank you for that call and that comment.
You're welcome.
Ariana, what do you think about that?
Yeah, thank you so much. Very insightful points. I myself, as an individual, am not necessarily fully comfortable with the idea of a universal enfranchisement, at least in America at this point in time. However, the argument I would like to focus on that you mentioned is this idea of taxation without representation. And the reason why oftentimes Vote 16 and the idea of expanding enfranchisement, especially in more progressive cities, is depicted by media as this radical progressive push to add more blue votes to the electorate. And that's simply not the case. And this argument of taxation without representation is the reason why Vote 16, although a polarizing issue, is absolutely a bipartisan. It's a bipartisan concept. And we've actually received received support from Republican congressmen and Republican senators because of that idea that written in the Constitution, essentially the core maxim as to why America became a democratic republic and fought in the American Revolution is the idea that every due-paying, tax-paying citizen deserves representation in its electorate. And currently we have hundreds of thousands of young people across the country that are due paying, but have absolutely no say in where that money goes. And of course, young people in San Francisco, when they pay taxes, those are federal taxes. And that would require a constitutional amendment to allow them to dictate whether or not where that money goes. However, young people in San Francisco pay their dues in other ways through paying for meters and enrolling in school systems and serving as political leaders. I myself wrote legislation for the city and served as a policy advisor, but was not enfranchised until a month ago. And as a city employee who was not paid because I'm a minor, the least I can have is representation in my electorate. So this idea that we are expecting certain adult level responsibilities of young people, but then taking away their enfranchisement, which is one of the core promises of American citizenship, is both unconstitutional, but also quite an uncomfortable concept to think about. And that disenfranchisement is purely on the grounds of social maturity and archaic understandings of what makes someone an eligible voter. So I absolutely appreciated your point in that universal enfranchisement, or not universal enfranchisement, but this idea that taxation without representation should serve as one of the core arguments for why young people should be enfranchised.
Great. And we now have Zara Emmett on the phone. Zara, are you there?
Yes. Hello.
Hi. Well, thanks for joining us. Zara's a producer for TBH, which is a KLW podcast. And we'd love to get your take on should 16-year-olds be allowed to vote?
Yes. I mean, I think so. I feel like, a lot of my friends and I were very excited about the whole voting process, and especially after the 2016 election. I mean, I was a freshman in high school at the time, and it like really impacted us, like all these decisions that were being made, and we felt like we didn't have a voice. And when it came, like, we had the League of Women Voters who came to our high school, and we all decided, okay, once we turn 16, we're going to pre-register, and we all did that together. And I think it's like there's decisions being made that affect us, and that's like something that really matters to us is to vote. And yeah.
What do you say, Zara, to people who, we've talked about this a little bit already on the show, but that 16-year-olds just simply aren't mature enough, and, you know, you're engaged, obviously Ariana and Tyler are engaged, they're sort of like the ideal people to be voting, but your average 16-year-old is just not paying attention to the elections. Why should we bring the voting age down to people who are so disengaged?
Well, I think if you bring the voting age down, it will, like, give teens to see this as a responsibility. Like, they'll see, like, oh, we now have a voice, and maybe we should be politically engaged. And I feel like a lot of politicians and, like, voting practices, they all talk to those people who are voting, and there isn't a large youth voter turnout currently, and they don't feel the need to address that there are like issues and concerns. But if you bring the voting age down and you have like youth voter turnout increase, I think they'll be forced to talk to them and care more about their issues and get youth engaged.
Well, Zara, I think you bring up a really good point, which is that because kids don't vote or teenagers don't vote, politicians don't speak to their issues. What do you think about that, John, that one of the good arguments of allowing 16-year-olds to vote is it will give politicians force politicians to pay attention to the issues that matter to teenagers?
I think you're absolutely right. Right here in San Francisco, right now, our school board is trying to change the Lowell High School admissions, trying to change the names of a lot of the different schools. There is no input from students on that. Now, these are controversial issues. It's not a matter of saying you're for them or against them, but students should be at the table. When we have the vote for the school board, we let people who vote who have not set foot in our schools in decades, who have no opportunity to know what's going on in our schools, Yet the students whose lives are affected, their futures are affected by our school board, they don't get a say. This would help change that.
So would Proposition G allow kids, as teenagers, to vote in school board matters, John?
Yes, it applies to all local elected offices as well as the local propositions.
Great. And Zara Ahmed, I want to thank you for calling in and providing your views. And Zara is a producer for TBH and a freshman at Ohlone College. Thanks for joining us, Zara.
Thank you for having me.
Great. And I wanted to address this other issue that opponents of the measure bring up, which is the undue influence of grownups. So, John, you mentioned that, you know, Lowell High School is figuring out how to do its admission system right now. And if kids were, and I'm sorry to say kids, teenagers or younger voters were allowed to vote, that they might be under the influence of their teachers or parents. They might not be making independent decisions. And therefore, because they're so easily swayed, they shouldn't be allowed to vote. What do you say to that, Tyler?
Well, talk to your 16-year-old. I think, like, we know that this is the point in our lives where we push back to the norms of what we're being told. And if you have a conversation with your 16-year-old, you can just talk about politics. You'll see that they have very different views from the ones that you hold. And I think we really have to push past this narrative of young people not understanding what they want or not making a clear enough analysis of the political context before they make a vote. Because it's held up by data that there's no difference in civic knowledge between a 16-year-old and an 18-year-old. So if we believe that an 18-year-old is prepared with all that they have to make an informed and independent vote, then there's that same basis for a 16 or 17-year-old in our communities.
Yeah, I think a friend of mine said, she's like, well, my 16-year-old never does anything I ask them to, so I can't imagine they're going to vote the same as me. But Ariane, I think you had a point to raise to that.
Yeah, absolutely. This was a question that was raised on Cal Penn's talk show a few weeks ago, and I was discussing it with him. And it's this idea of doctrination and the concept that, oh, young people are more susceptible to doctrination because their frontal cortex isn't fully developed. All these scientific phrases that are thrown out to provide legitimacy to a debunked argument. And a primary case study that debunks that argument is the 2016 election and the impact that essentially fake news and advertisements and foreign entities had on the currently eligible electorate shows that age is not a barrier for whether or not someone is susceptible to either false information or just simply believing what they see. Social media and the rhetoric that politicians use, those are all tools that all humans are susceptible to succumbing to unless they're extremely civically engaged and super familiar on the language. And the average American is not. That requires some level of active participation and essentially being fully submersed in the political world. And not every American is expected to be that, but every American falls victim to the rhetoric used in advertisements and essentially believing what they see at face value. So that's not something that's just a argument that applies to young people. It's an argument that applies to the American system. So rather than punishing young people for simply their human nature, why not reform the regulations around political advertisement and the language that politicians use in essentially convincing people to believe them, or just understand that doctrination is human and that allowing young people to vote and giving them the opportunity to have that civics education prior to voting will essentially act as a barrier to prevent further doctrination as they get older. So the currently eligible voters now who have access to the internet and the advertisements, that was not necessarily the case when they were in school. So there was not education around properly informing yourself and knowing how to check your sources and check your facts and therefore make a civically efficacious decision. However, young people, should they be enfranchised now, will have the experience from early on in learning how to navigate, how to use the internet as a tool rather than essentially a detriment for building one's political stance. So that idea of doctrination is not just applying to youth, but it's a human problem.
I think there's a fear that we're just one K-pop stan account away from, you know, somebody from that group deciding what the course of America will be. You know, another argument that people make against these propositions is that, you know, 18 to 23 voter turnout is pretty low and kind of and pathetic and anemic given how much we're hearing about, oh, that young people are leading all these movements. If the voter turnout for an 18-year-old to 23-year-old is so low, why should it be lower to 16, John?
Well, the fact of the matter is that the voter turnout in Tacoma Park, Maryland, and other places, it's higher than the 18 to 23-year-old group. And this isn't for everyone. This isn't in the same way that not all adults vote. But those who demonstrate, like Tyler and Ariana and so many others, demonstrate the capacity to do so, they will sign up and register to vote. And it's worked well in places as disparate as Ecuador and Denmark, Austria and Argentina and Brazil. So we love to be the leaders in San Francisco. We aren't the first. We're not going to be the last. This is an opportunity to extend the franchise to the 16 and 17-year-olds who can take an interest, whose lives are directly affected by our elected officials. And we believe that that vote should be extended to 16 and 17-year-olds.
You made an interesting point that these are not radical or brand new ideas. John, so the countries that you mentioned, is the voting age 16 in Brazil and Ecuador?
Yes, Austria, Argentina, Brazil, Ecuador, Norway, Scotland, Denmark, at many local jurisdictions around the country. And there we see the voter participation in that group is higher than the ones who register to vote later on in their lives. So this is something that we feel is important now, but it will extend into the future to have more participation in our democracy, and that ultimately strengthens it.
And John, or any one of you, there are some questions among voters. If they say yes to Proposition 18, but no to Measure G or Measure QQ, does that create a conflict, or is that a good way to split the baby?
No, the best way to, I wouldn't say split the baby in this case, the best way to go is to expand democracy. There is no conflict. The Proposition 18 deals with the statewide elections, the primaries, and the general election. The Prop G in San Francisco affects San Francisco local elections and the propositions. It wouldn't allow San Francisco 16-year-olds to vote for our assembly member or member of Congress. Over in Oakland, it's only for the Oakland School Board.
And so would Measure QQ not have the same problems that the Berkeley measure is having?
We'd want to make sure that that the Alameda County Registrar is able to implement it. So that's something that needs to be worked out. The principle, though, is really important, that 16 and 17-year-olds should be able to vote for the school board whose decisions or lack of decisions affect their lives on a day-to-day basis.
Right. And I think it was Tyler that you mentioned that for when we think of 16-year-olds, we're not always just thinking about that 16-year-old who we see on TV who has, you know, a mom and a dad and a nuclear family. There are a lot of 16-year-olds who are actually taking care of their family who, you know, I think in San Francisco, 70% of 16 to 17-year-olds are people of color, and they come from immigrant families, and oftentimes they are the primary interface for their family because of language issues. So that there are real responsibilities that 16-year-olds are having, and that when we think about this proposition, we may not want to be thinking about our next door neighbor's kid, but the people who live and work in our city. Is that right, Tyler?
That's exactly right. You have to really broaden the idea if you are thinking about as a young person in California, especially because our generation is the most diverse that the country has ever seen. So it tends to be very different from the idea that you have of a young person in your community. But we must uplift and continue to center to the young people of color, especially low-income young people of color, who have been going the extra mile in their homes by helping by getting a second job or babysitting or providing translation services, any number of ways. But we've been deeply connected and involved in our families beyond just being a child, but also in taking up the responsibilities sometimes of a parent figure.
Right. And we have one last minute. Ariana, what's the best argument to vote in favor of these propositions?
Sure. So for me, the primary argument for Vote 16 is a constitutional one and purely an American one. The logic behind the ratification of the 19th and the 26th Amendments was that we have a certain body of the population that are actively participating citizens. And the language that the Founding Fathers used and the promises of American patriotism and democracy is that citizens deserve the right to have a say in how they're being represented. That's what separates a republic from the other forms of national regulation. Currently, we have a situation where young people who are actively dues-paying citizens and participants in their community are being left out of a conversation, a legislative conversation, and that results in San Francisco becoming less and less of a family-friendly city. In order to resolve that, by expanding enfranchisement, you would essentially bring San Francisco legislation closer to full representation. And in the end, it's a question of whether or not you want to be on the right side of history, just as those who had the decision on the 19th and 26th amendments.
Well, and we'll have to leave it there. Thanks to my guests, Ariana Nasiri, Tyler Okoke, and John Trisvina, for telling us about the youth vote. There are three measures on the ballot. Make sure you look for those and read those carefully. Thank you guys again for being on the show.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you, Grace.
Yeah. And if you want to hear more election news, turn into Your Call this week, Tuesday through Thursday from 11 to noon for special election coverage. Also, the KALW News Team has created election briefs that go over local ballot measures, and you can find those on our website at kalw.org. Next up, we'll hear how one local musician is pairing musical performances with political campaigns to inspire political and social action. Stay right here for my interview with songwriter, musician, and activist Pete Cronowit. You just heard Do Something Now, a song written and performed by our next guest, Pete Cronowit. Pete is a musician and founder of Face the Music Collective. He hails from the East Bay and has taken a local idea of inspiring people with music to a national level, where he's partnering with campaigns across the country to motivate people to take political action. So I'm so pleased to have him on the show with us tonight. Welcome, Pete.
Hi, it's great to be here.
Great. Tell us a little bit, what is the Face the Music Collective?
The Face Music Collective, we're just a group of artists across the country, and there's a couple artists in Canada as well, who want to use our performances in a way that can have an impact more so than just the connection you build with an audience. It's to take that and direct it toward a good cause.
So you've been hosting concerts on Zoom, I assume?
Well, it's been Zoom and broadcasting on Facebook and YouTube as well.
Right. And how many concerts and how much money have you raised?
Okay, so currently we've done 31 shows for strategic and competitive campaigns in swing states. And we've also done additional shows for fundraisers, you know, live when we can do them in person. But we've also done some on Facebook as well. And we've raised about $45,000 right now.
That's impressive. This seems to be as much a protest movement as it is a get out the vote effort. And I was listening to some of the songs of the musicians who have played at these concerts. And one of them, I think her name's Dana Oberg, wrote a song, Nothing Rhymes with Orange. Let's take a listen to that one.
A walking slab of brain damage beneath the bad toupee. And a soul of orange oozing pus is hereby on this day inflicted and installed as our alleged president. And I guess it makes sense if you're a lobotomy patient.
Well, definitely has a point of view there about the current resident of the White House.
Music can be... you know, it could take a lot of different forms and motivate people in a lot of different ways. And I think sarcasm, humor, and being very biting is one great way to motivate people.
Yeah. And many of the musicians who've participated in these shows are their local artists. Many of them are unsigned, as far as I can tell. Has anybody gotten a record deal out of this, or has it helped to expand their platform?
I'm sure it's helped expand the musicians' platform in terms of playing in front of audiences that they definitely wouldn't gotten exposed to, because normally what we do is we play for campaigns in these states, and then the artists could be from other places, but we also seek artists in that local district because we want to draw people from that district, you know, because we're trying to support that campaign there. So, you know, in one example, someone with a bigger profile, Willie Porter played for a show in Wisconsin, and Willie's a national artist. But oftentimes they're local artists, and yeah, it's been a great experience for everyone involved, really.
Well, at the beginning of this pandemic, the Zoom concert was a novelty, and it was a nice way to get on your computer and just hear some music. Now that we've been having COVID for so long and we've seen everyone from like the cast of Hamilton to Lady Gaga on Zoom, is the format kind of losing its allure? And I'm just curious how you're trying to keep it lively and keep people engaged.
Yeah, I think you're right that initially this was a very novel thing for people, even people to talk on Zoom, let alone for concerts to be on Zoom. And you know, online events to connect with people. Restrictions have loosened up across the country and people are spending a little bit more time outside. But there are ways to, you know, to encourage people to still participate in these shows. And one of them is, you know, we still can't have live musical performances most places around the country. So this is a way to see artists that you know, and see them, you know, in a setting for a cause, and people want to support the cause, and you know, and see the artists that they love.
Are musicians all donating their time?
Yeah, all these artists are donating their time and their talent. Yeah, it's phenomenal. It's heartening.
This election, people are just so motivated to get out, regardless of what side you are on it. What happens after the election? Do you think that Face the Music Collective will stay around? Will you guys be able to continue with this effort? Or do you think that interest is going to wane once the November 3rd election is over?
Well, our calculation is that we can use our performances more effectively. And the idea is you don't have to partner with a political campaign. You can partner with an organization for any cause. And what you do is you work with that organization to develop a call to action during your show. It's something that seems so logical, but a lot of artists don't do that. So we're all helping each other kind of move that forward and, you know, help the organizations that we're partnering with as well. So, yes, we're going to continue with this concept and collective beyond the political campaign. And by the way, nobody believes that once this election is over – and things are just going to be magically better. You know, we're going to have to be persevering. We're all going to have to be working. The activist side of me, which is really kind of what's driven this whole collective, you know, understands that we need the kind of things that music does, that performance does, that, you know, when we gather, whether it's in person or online, to take that and to be able to, you know, to do something bigger than yourself. And that's how we, you know, make society a little bit better.
Well, I think it's nice to when you get together with like-minded people who want to do something, as your song says, but to also hear some music. I mean, it's hard to find those moments of respite and sort of beauty in this COVID time that we're all living with. So it's wonderful to have music. And sometimes for me, I look at listening to your music, a lot of undiscovered artists, people that I'd never heard of before, super enjoyable.
Oh, my. Yeah, I can't even tell you, like, the number of artists that I've discovered in doing this are just – yeah, they're just brilliant, brilliant artists, and they move people when we do these performances, and it's transformative even online. You know, I don't know how many people actually have been exposed to the rigor of a campaign. It's a 24/7 you know, experience. It's very difficult. So the thing is, this hour that we usually have for shows, it's very, very nice.
Well, I want to thank you, Pete, for being on the show. And it's great to hear your music. So, and to hear more of Pete Kronowitz's songs or to check out Face the Music Collective, go to his website, facethemusiccollective.org. Thanks for being with us, Pete.
Thank you so much. I appreciate being here.
And that's City Visions for this evening. Thanks to my guests, Tal Copen, Ariana Nasiri, Tyler Okoke, John Trusvina, and Pete Kronowitz. For a link to this and other City Visions shows, visit our page at KALW.org. Our engineer tonight was Damian Miner, and our producer was Jillian Emblad. Join us next week at 6 when we talk about school board elections. So good night, and don't forget to vote. Today's the last day to register. Go online to registertovote.ca.gov, and we're going to leave you with a little bit more Pete Kronowitz and his song, Stay Safe. Thanks very much. Have a safe night.
When this world is a little bit darker, you're the light I can see. If your arms cannot hold me, it's your love I still feel. And your heart is the